we go.
This is headed toward Knoxville and Oak Ridge.
Yeah, toward Knoxville. We didn't know we were going to Oak Ridge. Yeah. You know, we got into Knoxville. It was about 10:30 at night, and there were three Army trucks there. And they loaded us into the back of the Army trucks with our big old duffel bags, carrying gas masks. And we ended up in Oak Ridge. We didn't know it was Oak Ridge, but we had to go by. Oak Ridge at that time was behind barbed wire, and it was patrolled by MPs. So we had to go through an MP gate in order to get there. It was pitch black. We grew up in front of a one-story barracks, and the sergeant said, okay, go in and find a cot and get some sleep, and in the morning we'll tell you what you're going to be doing here. Well, we couldn't put the lights on because you'd wake everybody up, so these 19 guys piled into this barracks over here, and the only way you could tell was an empty bed.
Feeling a bed.
You know, when you hit something, you heard something. You, yeah. You know, that wasn't an empty bed, you see. And the next morning, they told us that we were part of the Manhattan. We were part of a Special Corps of Engineers. We were a Special Engineer Detachment. We're not going to tell you what you're going to be doing. We're going to divide the group up. Part of you will be working for Tennessee Eastman on a Y-12 project. Part of you will be working for K-25 on a gas distribution on another project. They didn't tell us what it was. Another project. And the third group will be at X-10 on another project. And they divided us up.
And you got the Eastman.
And I was sent to Eastman, Tennessee Eastman, and that time was the contractor.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember that we didn't have any air conditioning in those days, and the window was open, and so it was 17 weeks after. It was still the early fall. It was still hot down in Oak Ridge,
mm-hmm.
And this Army major said, "Well, this is the last time that you will hear this." He's up there. His mouth's going up and down, but this big tractor pulls out by the open window, and we never heard a word he said. Because we never mentioned the word uranium. In those days, it was called tubaloy.
Hmm.
It's a cool word.
That's what you called it, as metal hydride?
Yeah. We called it uranium.
Did you?
But it wasn't radioactive uranium.
Right. Yeah.
All we knew, we were just making pure uranium. We didn't know why.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't know much about this until I got down to Oak Ridge.
Mm-hmm.
And we were assigned to the gases, to the electromagnetic separation process. And we were my friend and I ended up in the same place that I did, and we were both laboratory foremen. We worked shift work, not unusual, 16 hours a day, and rotate, sometimes graveyard, sometimes day, sometimes. We took our job very seriously, and we handled and checked out the uranium fluoride. There were 85 freight cars that would come into Oak Ridge each day with supplies and material that they had, stuff to build buildings and what have you and so forth. Nobody else saw anything go out. Well, it went out in briefcases. We were making uranium-235. They wouldn't tell us we were making uranium-235. We had no safety precautions whatsoever, except as a chemist I would know that there was certain things that you would do and certain things that you wouldn't do. Okay. And the chemistry that we used was relatively primitive. Relatively primitive. This was a high security within the Tennessee Eastman process. It was a, we were double barbed wire within barbed wire.
Okay. Were you watched when you went out and ever much freedom?
Oh yeah, well, we were, it was on, we were on the base. We were on, it was considered an army base. We essentially could do what we wanted on the base. We had assignments, we had to meet our assignments. We lived in little huts. They'd be 4 men to a hut. It's like a tent, only had wooden walls and peaked roof.
Right, right.
And we had a kerosene stove that we could use. We had nothing to keep you hot, keep you cool in the summer, but we could keep fairly warm in the winter. We had an encampment area. We had a mess hall. We didn't have to stand for reviews or retreats or anything like that.
But everybody was in uniform.
Everybody. We had 1,800 men. 90% were PhDs. Everybody was in uniform. Everybody was a PVT. No stripes. For a full year, everybody was a PVT, which was fine. Which was fine. We liked, you know, we thought we were doing something that was important. Mm-hmm. We didn't know exactly what we were doing, but the longer we were there, the more we could learn.
Yeah, but so when did you get some kind of picture? Not till after the war, or did they give you little bits and pieces as you went along?
Oh, well, you figured it out for yourself. You talked to, you know, you talked to other guys, and they weren't supposed to tell you what they were doing. Well, they didn't. But, you know, over a bottle of beer sometimes, you want something, and you start putting two and two together, so we figured out.
Uh-huh. And you knew...
We didn't know anything about a bomb, but we knew pretty... We had an idea what we were working with.
And you knew enough physics to put some of it together, huh?
Yeah. Well, we could... You couldn't find any books in the library, because the MPs had a group that went around to local libraries and made sure that all those books that had that mentioned that word were taken off the shelves. We had MPs that were, security was very high. We had MPs that would be sweeping halls and cleaning restrooms. And you didn't know they were MPs. And the security was very, very high. Yeah. You trained, you would leave your badge, you had a badge with a picture, and when you went into the plant area, you would have to swap and get another badge. And then we would have to swap that badge and get another badge in our building. And what we would do is you go into a change room, you take off your military uniform, which are usually fatigues, and you get into a white shirt and white pants. And then we went through a turnstile like in the subways, but a high one. You know, not where you had to put any money, but I mean, if you went one way, you couldn't get out that way. Okay. And we'd go in naked and put on our uniform, and we'd leave the uniform there and then come out naked and then put on our other uniform. So you had two change rooms, really. And what they would do is they would, the uniforms would then go into a laundry, and they would try to recover anything that might be on the uniforms. Try to recover whatever they can recover. There wasn't very much uranium-235 made, but that was the uranium for the first bomb. Gaseous diffusion really didn't come online until after the war was over, and that because they didn't mind me. The third at X-10 was run by DuPont, and they had a computer out there which was a model for the Hanford Works. It's DuPont ran the Hanford Works too. It was interesting. You worked with the best people in the country. Anybody they wanted, they got. Didn't make any difference whether the guy was the president of a company. They wanted them, they got them. They moved them down, they put them in government housing, what have you, and so forth. There were 85,000 people behind this barbed wire head.
85,000?
Its peak, 85,000 people. 85,000 people. It must have been about, I suppose, between 30-35 square miles. each of the major plant areas was built in a different valley. And the reason was, in case one of them blew up, they didn't want to blow everything.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Blew up. They didn't know what was going to happen. They just didn't know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of blasting for construction purposes. And so, for a while, it was called the Kingston Demolition Range. And the natives would say, well, you know, it's a demolition range.
Speaking of the natives, you all must have overwhelmed the little town of Knoxville.
Well, Knoxville in those days was about 100,000 people.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I remember going into Knoxville. I didn't go into, couldn't go into Knoxville, I don't think, for about 3 or 4 months. I finally got a Class A pass, which would enable me to go into Knoxville for a day. And turn around and come back. And it was very interesting. I walked down the main street in Knoxville, Tennessee, which is called Gay Street, G-A-Y. And I remember there were three colored boys, black boys, that were on the sidewalk coming toward me. And when they got within 6 feet of me, they got off and walked in the gutter. I come from Maine, so I mean, I didn't understand.
Yeah.
I really didn't understand what all this was all about. I mean, it just didn't know. It was a completely different way of life. Different way of life.
Well, now, you were only allowed a limited amount of liberty?
Oh, yeah.
And had to be back by night?
I had to, oh, yeah. Had a class, so had to be back that night.
So here you were in uniform and still no social life.
No, well, no, I didn't, during the war, I didn't care. I mean, there were 1,200 other guys that had exactly the same problem.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, you had social life in Oak Ridge. There were 10 women for every man in Oak Ridge. So if you wanted social life, you could have social life. There were, the women really ran the plants. And women, they had no air conditioning, and during the summer they would, they wore white uniforms, but they would take the blouse and they would, the tails they would tie up underneath here so they have a bare midriff. And they'd splash some of the stuff on them. Well, uranium-235 is an alpha emitter. It's an alpha emitter. It does not, the alpha rays do not penetrate the skin. Beta, yes. Plutonium, terrible. But that's not a problem. I mean, I have no problem handling uranium-235. That was no problem at all. The problem you have is ingestion into your system. And occasionally, you know, you might get some acid. You take a shortcut, you get a little acid in your hands. Or you might inhale some stuff in the room. But whatever it was, it hasn't been that terribly harmful to me, because I managed to last a little bit longer.
Yeah.
Than, not a big problem at all. We lost some guys there, got killed on our project. They were electrocuted. Because when they had these huge magnets, like on the next separation, and you'd shoot this this gas in there, and the uranium, and the idea was that the heavier, and they'd be influenced by the magnet, and the heavier ones would land on one end of a target, and the light ones would land on another end, and I guess you dissolve what was on the heavy end, and you'd kill them. That's how you got uranium-235 in those days. They needed money, they needed copper to wind around the magnets. Well, there was no copper available. So they took a detachment of MPs in a railroad train, and they went down to Knoxville, Tennessee, and it took out $300 million in silver bars, and they went to a wire factory and they melted the silver bars and they extruded silver wire, and that's what wound the magnets. And that was why after the war was over they dismantled that plant and they took all that wire off, remelted it again, and back into silver bars and put them back into Fort Knox, Kentucky. Fascinating experience.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was exciting, the people that you'd work with. And you didn't mind that. I mean, you know, you didn't mind working 16 hours a day. That was not a problem.
Mm-hmm.
You were happy to do it because the alternative would have been worse.
Right.
My brother was with the 84th Division, and he landed on D-Day, and the 84th was assigned to the British 9th Army, and he fought all the way across France, and then on the that last German offensive, which was, remember, during the winter,
the Battle of the Bulge,
his company was told to attack. They were going to attack. They would move out that morning, no barrage or anything, but you'd move out that morning at 4 o'clock, 4 o'clock at night, and they were supposed to move to a certain area, dig in on the side of the hill, and wait for the rest of them. Well, you know, in the Army, things get screwed up more often than they don't get screwed up. That's the military. The attack had been called off, but nobody told these guys the attack was called off. So when it got light, the company was found out they were completely surrounded by the Germans. And they were all dug in. My brother was a VAR man. VAR man is automatic weapon. And so he was on one flank, not on the other flank. And the Germans, they held out against the Germans all morning, and the Germans called in Tiger tanks, and the Tiger tanks would just sit off there in the field and just start picking off the foxholes. And fortunately for my brother, they started to have a rent. And when they were, the first lieutenant and 5 men left, he surrendered. And so my brother was missing in action for quite some time. We didn't know anything. We didn't know where he was, because my brother refused to throw away his dog tags. And the dog tags had either C, P, or H, Catholic, Protestant, or Hebrew. And a lot of the Jewish soldiers, if they were going to be captured, would throw away the dog tags. But he wouldn't throw his dog tags away, so he was put in a concentration camp. Wasn't supposed to be, but that's the way they did things in those days. And so we didn't hear about him for a long, long time. So I went to my commanding officer and I asked for an overseas assignment. And I wanted to go to Europe. And he said, "You can't go." And it wasn't that I was, the rules were that anybody on that project could not go into a war zone. But they were afraid they would get killed. They were afraid they might get captured.
And so
we didn't find out about that for quite a while. I mean, what happened to my brother? And it was a fascinating story about him, because they made slave labor out of him. And there was another. There were several others that were captured like himself, and they would work in the fields during the day and then back into the camp at night. He said he went down to 95 pounds. And then towards the end of the war, the Allies controlled the air, and anything that moved them down on the ground that wasn't theirs, they would machine gun. Mm-hmm. And so he and this other guy decided that they were going to get killed. They weren't going to get killed by their own. They would get killed by the Germans, and he hated the Germans at that stage, and so they went under the wire one night and they escaped.
Wow.
And he said that they would hide in the fields during the day, they would move west, and the Germans were retreating before the Americans, and the Germans were moving east, and they'd go out on the roads at night. They'd hide during the day, and they'd go out on the roads at night. And I said, well, and there were no lights, and you'd keep bumping into German soldiers, but they couldn't see you, and you couldn't see them. It was just mass confusion. And he said one day they saw tanks that weren't American and weren't German, they were British. And the British picked them up. And he had no identification. That's the Germans taking everything. And they gave him a rifle, British uniforms, which he still has, and Jeep, and they were now behind British lines. And he said it was almost like an animal. He said he hated the Germans, what he'd seen. And so they would, anything was standing, they would try to knock down. And they'd go into a farmhouse at night, and they'd sleep, and then in the morning they'd leave. Towards the end of the war, the Germans started infiltrating the British and American lines with German soldiers in British and American uniforms. And he said they were sleeping in this farmhouse one night, and there was a banging on the door, and a door came crashing in, and then a bunch of American MPs and grabbed these two guys and threw them into an American POW camp because they didn't have any identification. They were wearing British uniforms. They weren't British. But you could tell them the way he talked, they were British. Okay. And they figured they must be Germans. And so they were there in the American POW camp for 3 or 4 days until they could sort out who they were and what happened and so forth when they shipped them back to this country.
Wow, what a story.
It's yeah. He had an amazing, amazing story. Amazing story. I want to tell you how I got into the information business.
Yes, this is right. That was my next question.
Fascinating story. Okay.
Now, you were in the Corps of Engineers until 46, is that what
46.
46.
46,
okay.
Yeah. In January 1946, war was on, now all the war was over in August. Americans were mustered out of the service. You were given points depending upon what your service were. If you were overseas, you got more points than if you were in this country, which made sense. And we didn't have any overseas assignments, so, you know, we weren't one of the first guys out. So in January, I did get a leave and went home for 10 days and came back and checked into the company headquarters, and there was the first sergeant was sitting there, and the first sergeant says, "Day?" I said, "Yes, Sarge." He said, we all had, by that stage, we were all non-coms, but this guy outranked us. He says, "Don't unpack your bag." I says, "I beg your pardon?" He says, "Don't unpack your bag." I says, "Why?" He says, "You're shipping out." I said, "What do you mean I'm shipping out?" He says, "See your name up on that list." So I go and I read this thing, and there was a notice that they had asked for 38 volunteers to go to Bikini, and my buddies decided it would be kind of interesting, and so they figured I ought to go with them too. So they volunteered me to go with them, you see. And my name was up on that list. Those are honors. Lamp was on that list. So the next day, or the day after that, I can't even remember, but it was very shortly thereafter, we were put on a train, and 38 of us were shipped to the West Coast. The day that we got to California, President Truman postponed the test for 6 weeks. I had to sign a waiver on my discharge, as did the other 37 men, because we just had to sign a waiver that but they guaranteed us that we would be back. All of us wanted to go to graduate school, that we would be back in the spring. And I think, well, that would give me enough time.
Now, this is 46.
46, January 46. We went out, so we are now on the West Coast. They didn't know what to do with us. Well, and these guys are not stupid. I mean, they were all educated guys and what have you and so forth. And we didn't know what we were going to be doing out there. They put us aboard the USS Haven. Fascinating story. USS Haven was a hospital ship. Spick and span, white, beautiful ship. And we were on the ambulatory ward, which is down at the bottom of the ship. So before we go on board, some second lieutenant comes around and says, "You men shipping out?" "Yes." This is January 1946. "Follow me." So he takes us to the supply, and they give us all this damn winter gear. All this winter gear, you see. Well, we have this big duffel bag, it must be this long, okay, stuffed with all of our gear. And now we got overcoats back and forth. You know, all this gear. And so when we get down into the ambulatory ward, you have to understand, this was for enlisted men. We were enlisted men. A Navy enlisted man has a locker that's 1 foot square. And everything he owns is in that 1 foot locker. Well, there's no way you can get this stuff in. So we get stuff hanging up all over the place. And they were three bunks high. And off of our ward, ambulatory ward, there was a toilet facilities, and then there was a separate facility where they had showers. And the way you would get showers down there is you would shoot live steam at the cold water. They would, I mean, the ship would do this, you didn't. But it came out pretty warm. Which was all right when the ship is moving, because when the ship is moving and the propeller is turning around, well then the ventilation system works, clear all that stuff out, you see. So, we get these 38 guys out, we don't have anything to do. We would lie in our bunks, we would read, we listen to the radio, you play cards.
You were supposed to be headed for a Bikini, is that right?
We knew that they were postponed for 6 weeks.
Oh, okay.
We saw it in the newspaper.
Yeah.
No, we told us, but we saw it in the newspaper. But we were aboard the ship, and they didn't have anything for us to do. The ship was captained by a Navy captain, and he reported to an Army colonel, which I'll come to in just a second. And so we were there about 3 or 4 days, and enlisted men can be like a bunch of pigs, if I must say so myself. And it's peer pressure. So, you know, guys with cigarette butts and what have you and so forth. So one day, there was a notice, I think it was Wednesday, there was a notice from going to the captain's inspection on Saturday. So it was in the dining area. So I said, when he came back, I said, hey guys, I think we better clean this place up. You know, it's captain's inspection. So you can imagine what happened. Hey, Dave wants to clean this place up. Well, I was the only guy that was going to do it. I'd be damned if I was going to clean up for 37 other guys. So I said, I wouldn't do it. So I wasn't doing it. So nobody did it. In the meantime, the steam was condensing on the wall. It was a mess. Saturday morning, I'm lying in my bunk. I was reading. And the bulkhead opens up. And in comes a chief petty officer. Hit the deck. Well, what's this hit the deck business? So, and in comes this Navy captain, you know, with a full commander and lieutenant commanders and full lieutenant, half a dozen officers there. And I could see him. This ship was spotless. All guys would do would be washing and chipping paint. I mean, that's how they kept guys busy.
Yeah.
But he couldn't tell us what to do. We weren't washing. Chipping paint. So he said, you don't mind all this? This has nothing to do with information. But it's leading to the information.
Leading to the information.
Leading to the information. So but I could see the color just drained from his face. This was his ship. And then it got red as a beet. And he'd walk around. Nobody stood at attention. Nobody even bothered to stand up. I closed my eyes. I could hear guys go, they're playing cards. You know, not a word, not a sound, except. And he say, and the captain turns to the chief petty officer, who's in charge down here? So he said, Lieutenant so and so. Well, there was an Army lieutenant that took us out to the West Coast. He had received a battlefield commission. He was a war hero. And he'd never been to the West Coast. They were giving him, doing a favor. He went with us. He was